So where are we? Beginning?
This is November 16th, 2012. This is Ina Gusenfeld interviewing Anthony Tung for the New York Preservation Archive Project. So we're going to begin. You were appointed to the Landmarks Preservation Commission in 1979, and if you could describe how you came to the city's attention.
Kent Barwick was the chairman at the time. He had been appointed by Ed Cox. Is your recorder going? Okay. The commissioner from Staten Island was leaving her seat, and there was 1 year left on it. So he was looking for someone to replace that commissioner. And according to the schedule of how many architects, one developer, a landscape architect, a historian, a representative for every borough, according to that whole formula, he thought he was looking for an architect from Staten Island. Although the person who I followed wasn't an architect, but that was just the way it was working. So he came out to Staten Island to go to a cocktail party, and he had been chairman of the State Council of the Arts, or executive director. And so during the years he'd been the executive director, I had been working in museum education, running a program out of the Staten Island Museum. And it had struck, he told me this later, it struck Kent as unusual that when he would meet with his staff to evaluate museum education programs around the country, around the state, they would talk about the Met, the Modern Museum of Natural History, and the Staten Island Museum. And that would happen year after year, and he'd say, "What's going on out there?" And they said, "There's this guy, his name is Tony Tung." So Ken came out to a cocktail party on Staten Island and asked someone, "Who is to architecture on Staten Island what Tony Tung is to the arts?" And that person said, "Apparently you don't know, he has a degree from the Cooper Union School of Architecture." And so that's how I came to the attention of Kent and the mayor.
The press described you as an educator who had moved away from architecture and city planning. Did your appointment to the commission mark a return to your original training?
Mm-hmm. Very definitely. It was more than that. What I'd studied in college, I'd gone to this Cooper Union School of Architecture and studied with some great modern architects like Peter Eisenman and Rick Scofidio and John Haydock and Charles Guathme. So I was exposed to some people who were brilliant in design, but the thing that interested me the most in college was when I started studying city planning. And I got very involved in it, and eventually the school let me do a year and a half of independent study in city planning rather than doing the other design courses. So I gave myself a good grounding. I was studying on my own largely. Mm-hmm. But I read all the material that was in the Cooper Union Architecture School.
So you weren't
library.
Taking courses somewhere else?
No, I wasn't taking courses. It was just independent study. I just walked into the library and started reading all the books and read Jane Jacobs who's the guy who wrote The City in History and The Culture of Cities?
Not Mumford.
Yes, Lewis Mumford.
Okay.
I hardly understood what he was talking about. But I knew he was really smart. So when I got on the Landmarks Commission, I'd been pursuing design, and I'd done a lot of freelance design since I graduated from school. But I hadn't been doing architectural design. But when I got on the Landmarks Commission, I began to realize that the issues I was dealing with in terms of public policy had to do with what interested me when I was in school, which was the planning of the architectural future of the city. Mm-hmm. And so once that, there wasn't a moment where I said, aha, a light bulb went off in my head. I just became more and more engaged and started committing more and more of my time to this. At first, just to be a good commissioner. But then it just naturally was so absorbing to me that eventually it became my vocation. And so after I left the commission, eventually I wrote a book. I traveled around the world. I've lectured around the world. So it's become what I do, which is to write and think about these matters. That interest gradually emerged as I was being a commissioner.
At 32, I believe you were the youngest member ever appointed to the commission. And did you feel that this influenced your career at LPC to any extent?
No, there was nothing to compare it against, and it didn't matter. When I was getting on the commission, I had a friend who was a political advisor, and he said, "This is a really good appointment because it's a blue ribbon appointment." And I said, "Well, what does that mean?" He said, "Well, there are people on the Landmarks Commission who are actually qualified to be there." And he said, "A lot of city commissions have commissioners who aren't qualified." Well, that was sort of shocking to me, but I grasped it. Anyone who's lived in Olympic City grasps that concept. But when I got on the commission, what I saw was that half of the commissioners were doing the actual work of the commission, which is making the motions and thinking through the issues. And the other half of the commissioners weren't capable of doing that. They couldn't evaluate a design for appropriateness. So someone who had a sense of pride, I didn't want to be someone who was just taking the ride. I wanted to be someone who was participating, and it was my field after all. So I just spent an awful lot of time in the beginning, at least 20 hours a week for the first couple of years. I think I was probably spending 20 hours a week for all my time on the commission, but in the first couple of years, I was spending 20 hours a week just learning how to be a commissioner. Mm-hmm. And I became gradually one of the commissioners who was making the commission go, who was making motions, participating in the debates. And then felt I was giving proper service rather than just being someone who was just filling a seat. No.
Yeah. To that end, what was your approach to the designation and protection of historic properties? And did you have particular ideas about landmarks and the role of the commission?
Somewhere pretty early on, when I was on the commission, I asked one of the staff people to give me an idea of how much of the city might potentially be designated. And they said, "Well, we don't really know." And that was the point at which Kent was trying to get a computerized survey going. He may have begun it at that point. But the staff person I was speaking to said that we have surveys of the city from the time by different preservation citizen groups in different parts of the city, from the time when the commission was first founded, that give an idea of how much material there was. Mm-hmm. So I looked at those surveys and came away with the impression that somewhere between, if everything that they recommended was designated, somewhere around 2 or 3% of the city would be eventually designated. I had some idea of the percentage. It wasn't that exact. It was, but I knew it was something like that. So with that in mind, I began to realize, as I was sitting there at the commission hearings, that what was happening was we couldn't pursue a rational sequence of designations. And the reason we couldn't do that was, and this is part of the character of the commission at the time when I first joined it, is that as the courts ruled on the preservation matters, they began, through their rulings, to establish guidelines for how we should proceed. One of the things that had profound impact was early rulings on questions of whether a designation was arbitrary and capricious or not. Arbitrary and capricious is the standard under law against which administrative actions are judged in the courts. So for a designation, a judge wanted to see that we had reasons that were rational. And what gradually occurred out of several court rulings was it became clear that the commission had to establish a standard. It didn't have to publish it. And this was something I always was fighting with Dorothy Minor about during the times I was mm-hmm. at the commission. I wanted to publish the standard. And because I asked her, "What is the standard? And now what are the courts looking at?" And she said, "Well, basically is the standard that comes from the National Trust." And so it was, this a work of an architectural genius? Isn't a building important in terms of type? Isn't a building important, significant in terms of style? Does it have high artistic merit? Does it have an association with the cultural history of the city? Does it have technological merit? There may be some other elements in there from that National Trust set of standards. And when I started reading the court cases, I saw the judges were looking at things like that too. They would say, okay, this is rational, this is a rational designation because they've established through testimony and documents that Ernest Flagg is a prominent American architect. They've established that this is one of his important works. And then he would go through and say, well, this is an important residence of Ernest Flagg. Well, this was a courthouse building, and it's one of the finest courthouses of that period. It's done in this style. So the judges were going through and looking at the way we compiled facts. And what that did in terms of designations was it made the writing of a designation report a much more detailed and laborious process, which was good on one hand. First of all, the merits of doing that is that the property owner knows why you're designating right. their property. But it has really profound impact when you get involved with historic districts. Because what really ought to be happening with a historic district is every building in the district should be described in terms of the degree to which it contributes to the distinctive character of the district. And that gradually is pretty much what came to happen with our designation reports. And the more I was involved in regulation, the more I began to realize it was, and would call, as a commissioner, called for having designation reports of greater detail. So, but what all that did was it made the designation process very laborious. So it became very clear there wasn't any way to sit down and make a hierarchical list of what was most important to save in the city of New York and just go through it in that rational right. order. Because what obviously would happen would be certain areas of the city would get stimulated economically and start to be developed. And if you didn't make your designations in that area prior to all that activity, then you'd try to be coming in at the last minute. So as much as possible, what occurred was the commission tried to be aware of potential new developments and get in a year or two ahead of time, some amount of time ahead of time. And that changed, that altered the rational sequence that you might otherwise have followed. So that was clear pretty quickly that this was going to be a less than fully rational process. So that in terms of designation, were you asking about more than designations in that question?
I was asking about your particular approach to designation and okay. protection, and what were your particular ideas about coming in as a commissioner?
Okay,
about
so then when faced with this condition, in terms of designations, as much as possible, I was in support of rationality. One of the things that the commission did I always thought was good was, for instance, once we started designating, I remember we designated a bunch of schools by the architect Schneider. And that was great to do a whole group of them, to get one body of research done and then do a whole group of those buildings all at one time. So I always thought that made a lot of sense. Districts make sense just because they are a grouping in and of themselves of a whole part of the city. So in terms of designations, I think I wasn't any different than the other commissioners in that we all would have liked to see the process be more rational, but we knew we couldn't, so we lived with the political realities of it. The only thing I would say that was somewhat different from my part was I was very much in favor of designations of things that were less beautiful architecturally, but might have cultural significance. So during my time as a commissioner, I really wanted for us to designate the Sandy Ground area on Staten Island, which is an area where freed blacks from Maryland came up from, and they were oystermen and made a community mm-hmm. on Staten Island. It was an area where the buildings were very modest, but the meaning of the buildings was extraordinary. But my fellow commissioners had problems with that. I think I should say that Elliot Wilensky, who was someone I served with and was the author of the AIA Guide, and I became very close friends with, was someone who was very much in support of these kinds of designations. And that carried a lot of weight because he was so well respected by the other commissioners. And so having Elliot be in support of that at least raised a question in everybody's mind about whether it was legitimate or not to pursue those kinds of designations. And Kent, as chairman, was also someone who was sensitive to these things too. It always posed a political reality. And the political problem associated with these kinds of designations is when people who are less sensitive to these matters, but maybe a city council member from that particular area on Staten Island, for instance, would go and look at the buildings, they'd say, well, how can that be a landmark? Because it doesn't look like a landmark in terms of its architectural characteristics. They're not seeing the relationship of the forms of the landmark to the deeper cultural meaning. So that's always a problem if there happens to be a fight about whether the designation should occur or not, because it can be difficult then in the newspapers, and the editor of a newspaper might not see the beauty of an Oyster Man shack. One had to be careful about pursuing those designations. The other thing that was true at that time was because we were in the early history of the commission and there were questions about the constitutionality of the landmarks process, that our counsel, who was really a superb counsel named Dorothy Minor, who served at the commission for a very long period of time. And it was one of those lucky things for the city of New York to have someone like Dorothy. I believe she had a master's of law from Columbia and also a master's in preservation. So she was extremely well equipped. She was someone, you know, she eventually taught at Columbia after she left the commission, but she was someone who would have been gobbled up by private practice had she wanted to go in that direction. Instead, she chose to serve the city for all those decades and became recognized in the United States as one of the most prominent thinkers about preservation law, and she even consulted with foreign nations about preservation practice. Mm-hmm. So it was wonderful to have her as counsel. And one of the things she said was, we want to try to always make a very affirmative record. So we don't want to lose court cases, and we don't want to have designations turned back at the city council. And so she would push us to err a bit on the side of caution in terms of these matters. I think that part of being a commissioner, of understanding that it was a relatively new law and that it hadn't been fully tested in the courts, was one of the elements that really weighed on how we all acted in regards to these matters, because one feels a fiduciary responsibility, especially to future generations, not to suddenly create a condition where the landmarks law is weakened as a result of court rulings that were unsympathetic. So it isn't so much a matter of, your question had to do with what I was interested in. It isn't so much a matter of where I was interested as much as what I encountered, of what the condition was. One was responding to the condition. There were a number of court cases involving designations and a number of court cases involving hardship rulings. There were very few court cases that reversed a decision of the commission on a certificate of appropriateness. So one understood that when making C of A rulings, we were on a ground that was much less contentious legally. Mm-hmm. But when making designations and hardship findings, we were on ground where we had to really, many of the guidelines by which we pursued those activities came to us as a result of different court rulings, and one ruling after the other, as with the designation.
And were these at the state level, for the most part, with the exception of Penn Central?
Yeah, I guess so. I can't remember exactly half the rulings back in my house, and you can come and interview me in my house, and I'll tell you that. We can look it all up.
How would you characterize the atmosphere at the commission in the wake of the Penn Central decision?
I didn't understand when the Penn Central ruling came down. I didn't understand why it was so significant. Dorothy must have explained it to me, and probably Kent did too. I remember the day. I remember Kent being extraordinarily happy. Mm-hmm. But I think everyone who was on the commission just was so absorbed in the realities of what you were facing day to day. You came in, there was a list of things you had to attend to. There were so many C of A items, and you had to tend to them in a timely fashion. And construction was going on. People's lives are going on. And one of the things you become aware of on the first day you make a C of A ruling is when you everything you rule on has a potential negative effect on someone's life. If I rule in favor of this design, well, then the people who are opposed to it, who are living in a neighborhood and may have worked for 10 years bringing this neighborhood back, restoring their own houses, doing all kinds of things that good neighbors do, are stuck with a bad design on that corner for the next two decades, right? On the other hand, if you turn the design down, then maybe the architect who got that commission loses the commission. Maybe that's the commission that's holding up his practice. Maybe he goes out of practice. Maybe the owner of the building feels they can't afford to build something that's appropriate, and they sell the building. You don't know what the consequences are. And it's potentially negative on either side. And at some point during my first C of A day, mm-hmm. when I came to grasp that, I got much more serious once I realized those kinds of repercussions. So then when every commissioner has that well in their mind, when you sit down, you're being very attentive to just doing justice to the matters that are coming before you, really thinking them through as well as you can. You understand that very rarely is there a perfect answer, or an absolute answer. You're just trying to think through, get the best human reasoning out onto the table and applied to what's in front of you. And I think, so the question about the Penn Central ruling, I guess the way it affected it didn't really affect me. And I don't think, I think we were already affected in this sense. We were living in a climate where we were very aware that these early rulings were determining the standards by which we were functioning. So I would say that nothing changed. We just continued in that same mode, and it was a sensitivity that came from the early decades of the commission. So Dorothy had that from her years on the commission, and Beverly Moss Spatt was a member of the commission when I was a commissioner. She had kept her seat, and so I was exposed to her thinking. And several of the commissioners had come from earlier generations of the commission. But this was also true of the staff. There were many staff members who had come from the early decades of the commission, and they had a consciousness which evidenced the fact that they knew they had been involved in a social revolution. I mean, I really envied the first... I wish I could go back now and talk to some of them. I didn't quite grasp all this at the time. I just had a sense of it. But some of them were there from the early days of the commission. I mean, creating how you do a designation. How do you think about this at all? How do you write a designation? Thinking about things in the most primal kind of ways, because nobody had done this in the city of New York. And so there was a feeling from those early staff that of being involved with having a great social purpose. You really had that sense of a social revolution. And if you're appointed, you just walk into that. And so I walked into that sensibility, along with the sense of part of the revolution had to do with our relationship to the courts and to the press and to the elected bodies we were functioning with. And so that was the climate. And Penn Central changed it a little bit, but not much. We still were in that climate of being very thoughtful about these matters. I would wonder, I think it would be interesting to ask a person who's appointed was appointed 2 years ago, how much of that kind of sensibility is still weighing on commissioners? Because I think we're far enough away from these early things that it's just taken for granted that this is a constitutional activity.
You mentioned Dorothy Minor, and you mentioned other commissioners like Elliot Walensky. How did you relate to the other commissioners during your tenure, like Elliot, like Adolf Plachek?
The commission, when I was first appointed to it, was, it may have been one of the better commissions to ever been put together. It had Elliot and Kent, who were, for those who don't know, was extremely active as a citizen activist and head of various organizations in preservation before he came to the commission with South Street Seaport, and probably around 10 or 20 different things. It was just something he was interested in. And Elliot had, so he was one of the prime principal movers in the city in these matters. Elliot, of course, had written the AIA guide. The vice chairman of Kent's commission was Bill Conklin, who is sort of a minor figure in American architectural history books in regard to the design of the Reston Newtown, the Lower Manhattan Plan. And everyone in preservation knew him at the time because he had designed Butterfield House, which was considered one of the best examples of a modern infill building in a historic district that was sympathetic and yet retained its integrity as a modern design. There, on that commission also, Beverly Moss Spatz, we had a former chairman on that commission as well. We started out, we had Michael Brown, who was the head of one of the nation's societies for interior decorators, and so he was formidable in his knowledge as well. And Barbara Lee Diamondson Spielvogel, who eventually wrote the book about New York City's landmarks and had been involved in cultural affairs and had a television or a radio program interviewing people in the arts in New York. Mm-hmm. And Charles Klatt, who was an architect of some substantial accomplishment. He was an architect in those days before the internet. It was hard to get have your work published in architectural journals. They only published, 10 or 20 things a month. And so an architect whose work was frequently published in architectural journals meant they were someone in the upper 5 or 3% of all the architects functioning. Charles was that kind of architect. So given that, that's a lot of firepower. When you look at later commissions, I think there are, be hard-pressed to find a commission that had so much intellectual firepower on it. I, of course, didn't know that when I came on. I was just walked in. Again, I walked into it. I was very lucky. I walked into a great commission. And people were older than me and much more experienced. And what my sense of this was, Kent felt strong about my appointment. And after a couple of weeks and a couple of sessions, I started speaking. And I remember at first, people would look and go, oh, he speaks. And then, oh, he speaks coherently. Oh, he made a good point. And people in that situation are just trying to do the best job they can. And it's hard to solve a lot of these things because sometimes you're dealing with questions in which there isn't a good answer. And so you want all the brain power you can have directed at the solution of a problem in the room. So you just want it there. So gradually, I began to be accepted as someone who could think a bit, and gradually I learned how to speak. And eventually I became someone who was making motions. And in those days, we largely made motions that were extemporaneous. That may be because as Elliot and I came onto the commission, we both started, after a year or so, pushing design regulatory policy to be a bit more aggressive, and which meant that the staff couldn't anticipate the rulings as well prior to a C of A meeting, and so their staff reports were less, we would frequently end up changing them, and So it was a period where policy was more in flux, and it was the policy was being formulated in these public discussions. And I remember it was very difficult to learn how to make an extemporaneous motion, and not just for myself, but in watching other people come onto the commission, probably 4 or 5 years onto the commission when Gene Norman was chair. I remember seeing David Todd come onto the commission. David Todd was a very skilled person in terms of public affairs and speaking about architecture, and he was quite a bit older than me, maybe 20 years older than me, 30 years older than me. And you just wouldn't have thought that he would struggle with this. It took him a while. I remember him going, okay, I'm going to try to make a motion today. And saying that. And if I get this, any of this isn't too good, someone step in and help me.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just a hard thing to do. But what it does, if you have a commission that's making motions that way, rather than reading staff reports, it's you have a commission that's thinking with one member with the other and formulating ideas and also listening to the public and taking their ideas and bringing them in to the thought process on the table. And that makes, I would learn, and we'll talk about this later, with time, that is what made the process much more fruitful in terms of it being a participatory and democratic process. It also then, engaging the public also had this inevitable effect of raising the regulatory design standards. So here is one of the things I recognize as a young commissioner. I'd been on the commission for some short period of time, and I began to realize there were these annoying people from Greenwich Village. And one of them was a woman by the name of Ruth Wittenberg, and who I didn't know any of the history of New York and its advocacy, so I didn't know she was someone who had worked with Jane Jacobs and had fought to create the Landmarks Law, the Greenwich Village designation, fought to stop Robert Moses and all that stuff. She was coming to the commission. She was in a wheelchair. She was being wheeled in by a woman named Verna Small, who also was a number one of these primary people from Greenwich Village who have to change the city. And they would come in, and we would hear testimony on designs for Greenwich Village, and they would stand up and be asking for a higher standard of review. No, that isn't an appropriate storefront. No, it could have, we want it to look more traditional. We don't want to have it all modern glass. Whatever it was, they were always pushing for something higher. And at first I remember feeling I was being annoyed by this because I just thought I knew more than they did, because I was a graduate of the Cooper Union School of Architecture, and they weren't a graduate from architecture schools. But at some point I realized that they were asking for more substantial design review than the commission was giving. So at a certain point I also then began to realize that I was interested in that as well. So I began speaking for things that they were asking for in the public hearings. I would end up in the debate trying to support those kinds of ideas. It was always, I think it's funny to me looking back at it, because at the time I was always kind of like uncomfortable with the idea that I was taking their position. But it's gradually, as Elliot and I continued on the commission together, we both were pushing for this. And we got higher and higher design standards. So again, another part of the whole process, the early process of being commissioner, is beginning to understand the dynamic of the public forum, which I had no comprehension of when I came in. I didn't understand that this was democracy in action. It actually was democracy in action, but I didn't understand that. I just thought it was architectural review, like I'd done in school, right? The professors stand up and tell you what's good and what's bad.
Hey, do a crit.
That's right. Yeah, and then you find out in when you're on the Landmarks Commission, it's just not that simple, in large part because the preponderance of the material coming before the commission was designed by people who weren't very good architects. They just weren't the better architects. And even if they were better architects, they didn't have budgets that allowed them to exercise their talents. And so you're constantly dealing with very compromised situations. And what we often were doing was trying to avoid the worst kinds of consequences for buildings. You just to avoid something that was so totally detracting. You know, you're trying to get some modicum of harmony. And that was true with a lot of the applications that came before us. But that also now, in looking at it, I realize in retrospect, had to do with the effect that historic preservation laws would have on the evolution of design consciousness in architecture across the United States, in that gradually there would be more and more schools that would teach how to do contextual design, and there would be more and more discussions about this and articles about it. And gradually, the whole quality of contextual design would improve across the whole field with the passage of decades, very much propelled by by having preservation laws, because every architect came to be that more and more architects would get these kinds of commissions and would have to engage these kinds of intellectual questions. So I think the results I see when I walk in the historic districts of New York today are much better than the results we were seeing when we were doing this. And in that era back then, we were trying to establish some of the fundamental concepts for what made good contextual design. And part of it was coming from the community groups and individuals who were testifying. But I guess I'm involved in all this. It's all part of the weave of what was happening. Because you were asking what it was like to be a commissioner. What it was like is you walked into a particular set of conditions that had to do with the historical development of the commission, I think I was responding to those conditions. What came out of it, of response to those conditions, after a year or two of doing regulation, I had a very determined feeling that we had to raise. It was better for the city if we raised the quality of design regulation. Because what I realized was there's a certain expenditure of human energy going on with every application that is going to happen one way or another. And I began to realize that that doing it well did involve more energy. and there's a multiplier effect. So I ruled on over 2,500 applications during the year, eight and a half years I was on the commission. So what's that, 300 applications a year? If you multiply that out across, those 300 applications are only the tip of the iceberg, because the Landmarks Commission staff is granting permissions for new construction for something like, I guess, 5 to 10 times that number of applications every year. So thousands of applications of every year, 3,000 applications. Over a decade, it's 30. Over two decades, it's 30,000. It's 60,000. So it starts accruing in the built environment. And if you can get all those decisions to just be a little bit better, then that much more beauty is accruing over in the built environment over time. When I came to grips with that notion, I just started pushing more and more to increase the rigor of the regulatory process.
So you mentioned community groups, and I understand that your term coincided with the emergence of a number of important preservation groups in the late 70s and the 80s. And I was curious if you could speak to how they influenced the designation process and what their relationship really was with LPC. I know that the Historic District Council didn't always have a very good relationship with the commission.
I wouldn't characterize it that way. I wouldn't say the Historic District Council didn't have a very good relationship with the commission. I would say it just depended on from what seat you were sitting in, mm-hmm. and what particular issue. Community groups, for the most part, the role they play is to set a standard, which is a standard just based on what they think is important to achieve in reality. A bureaucracy is dealing with all of the restraints within which it's operating, which couldn't be political. It can have to do with the mayor's office not being sympathetic to designations or city council members not being. So what the community groups do is hold out that standard. When someone like Kent is in office, I think he exceeded the standard of the community groups much of the time. But when, for instance, when Jean was chair, in the area of designations, he wasn't designating anywhere near as many buildings as Kent was. And then the community groups had a more adversarial relationship to the commission in terms of just applying pressure to increase the number of designations. I think that's just fundamentally important. And Historic Districts Council was a young organization when I first came on the commission. I guess what was significant about Historic Districts Council was during the time I was on the commission, a lot of their members came and testified at the commission. They weren't sending an executive director down. I don't think they had an executive director. So the people who were coming to testify, like Christabel Goff and Arlene Simon and Peg Moore, Jack Taylor, Helena Rosenthal, and others, were people who were the heads of preservation groups in various communities. And they sat on the board of the Historic District Council. So I think what was occurring, just as a matter of observation, is they would come to the commission, they would hear the discussions, they would testify on various items, see the way they were ruled on, and bring back those results to the table. And people in the Historic Districts Council would sit and talk about all that and say, well, why did you get a better shop front? We didn't get an improved shop front. And why are your houses, was that well restored and they didn't do it with us? And they started talking about the dynamic of how the commission made its decisions and what the criteria were. And I think what happened was that was a co-educational kind of process where they were all educating one another. And one of our founding fathers and James Madison said something about the fact that a true democracy is constituted by a small group of citizens who are informed and bring that information to the public decision-making process. And I think that stress on the idea that it's not just open for everyone to participate in, but it's people being informed is very important. And I guess one of the things I had to learn as a commissioner was that sometimes private citizens were more knowledgeable than I was, though they didn't have a degree. Okay? And so what I learned was people would study the architectural history of starting out of their studying their neighborhood, but then we gradually become very conversant for the city as a whole. And they could become very conversant in terms of design as well, design regulation. And so what was happening with groups like the Historic Districts Council was, and I thought it was very potent in its impact in the early days because its board members were actually coming to the commission and actually testifying, which is much different than having a paid professional come and testify. The reason it's much different is when someone from a community comes in and testifies, they bring a certain moral weight because when Peg Moore came, she had, you know, was involved in getting 5 houses on her block restored to a higher quality. They bring the weight of all of their positive involvement in making the preservation process unfold. So that causes commissioners to listen in a different kind of way because you're dealing with someone who's really, they're putting, I've forgotten the slang expression I was going to say there. So I think the Historic Districts Council was very important in those days because of that. And as we go on and I talk more about the involvement of his groups, I'll talk about how they eventually empowered me as a commissioner. I was able to move more and change the quality of design regulation because of the way I ended up collaborating with those groups. MAS had a different kind of impact. Municipal Art Society had always had, because it was an organization that was well-funded, it always, and had people on its board who were looking at larger urban issues, had a different kind of breadth of perspective when it came in to testify. And so on certain issues, they were more potent. Like on the Broadway theaters, they would really have gather a bunch of people in a committee to think it through. And their testimony would be very substantive. But the power of the mind is the power of the mind. So one of the things that's very fascinating as I watched this, and as you can still see it today, is one of the smallest groups in the city is one of the most potent, and it's the Society for the Architecture of the City, and it's Christabel Goff, and actually has two other people as well. It's three or four people, because there's another historian who's involved with them. And they can come in on large city issues and offer up a position paper that will knock the socks off everybody. So that's just part of the process. You begin to learn that certain people are really thinking in more substantive ways. But in the beginning, I think I was responding to the people who were coming from individual groups from a particular community talking about the impact of a proposed design in their community. The impact on designation is different. And the reason it's different is because there's a certain amount of the designation process that's hidden from public view, which is how the commission makes the decision of what could possibly be the list of potential things to be designated. And it eliminates a lot of things in that process. And there's a political problem here in terms of... Yes, I should move away from the table when I'm talking about this, because this is important. Okay, one of the things that bothered me when I was a commissioner was that was the way the designation process was working. And one of the things that was of concern to me was when we were dealing with designations in the outer boroughs, we had a somewhat different process than when we were dealing with designations in Manhattan. So here's an important political distinction to understand. Designations in Manhattan were much less subject to politicalization in the borough of Manhattan. I guess because there were so many powerful citizen groups in Manhattan that borough presidents didn't dare intrude directly into the designation process. But once you got to the outer boroughs, they would. And so if someone got to a borough president and in terms of their property and they were a friend of the borough president, so someone was contributing to their campaign or whatever the reasons were, we never fully knew, the borough president could block the designation. And the way this was done at the Board of Estimate was the Board of Estimate had a tradition that on items that were purely local, all of the borough presidents would vote with the local borough president. So if a borough president on Staten Island wanted to block a designation, then all the other borough presidents would vote with that. I should say regardless of the merits. It seemed to me it was regardless of the merits. Yeah. And that was just the way the politics worked. So what was happening when I got on the commission, what I realized after a while, was that the commission was sending a list of potential designations to the borough president's office. And the borough presidents would alert the commission to designations they weren't going to support. And if it seemed like their feelings were strong on the matter, the commission would not bring those items forward to a designation hearing. So when I became aware of this, it took a couple of years before I learned all this, I was very unhappy with it, because what it was doing, it was giving borough presidents a veto over designations for reasons that often did not have anything to do with the substance of the matter. And that was very disturbing, because it was also hidden, because the public never knew about this. And this, I should say in fairness, it was going on during Kent's term as chairman and during Gene's term. And as I stayed on the commission, and I eventually became one of the people who brought those lists to the borough president's office. On Staten Island, in my later years, I was the one who was bringing the list and talking with them about it and trying to assuage their concerns when they were opposed to a designation, although one could never know exactly why.
Could you, speaking to that, could you elaborate on how you felt the mayor and the Board of Estimate influenced the landmarks process and how political pressure in general affected the commission's latitude for independent judgment?
Mayor Koch was, it seemed to me, fundamentally in support of historic preservation. I would characterize him as a pro-preservation mayor. And he pointed good people to the commission. The Board of Estimate was just politicized. But the mayor's impact on the Board of Estimate was to fight for designations. That's what he did. And so when after the commission designated things and they would come to the Board of Estimate, he or his representatives would fight to accrue the votes. And sometimes they would end up being in a fight with the borough presidents. So when you see that, you see that there's a potential to be in a fight with the borough president over a designation as a chairperson, you begin to realize there's only so many times you can go to the well here. You can't designate 20 items a year which are going to be contentious at the Board of Estimate, because then you have the mayor fighting to uphold all those designations and using up political capital to do that. So that the fact that that politicized process was existing is what caused the chairman to act with restraint in terms of bringing forward items that were politicized. As a young man on the commission, my feeling was I'd rather have the designations go forward to the Board of Estimate. I would rather the commission heard these contentious items, designated them, and had the borough president stand up and say I'm opposed to the designation and have it be turned down. I thought that was a better way to go, because then the political heat for not designating would have fallen on the borough president. But what the counsel of the commission pointed out to me is that, and I can hear Dorothy at this moment saying, Tony, if you get the Board of Estimate turning down 5, 10, 20 designations a year, you're establishing a precedent for their acting in that way. And then there will come a time where they start looking at things on the basis of other realities and turning things down. So she was very concerned about not having that negative record. She wanted to have a condition. As a lawyer, she thought the better condition was that the Board of Estimate would only on the rarest occasions turn back a designation that the commission had made. As someone older and looking at that, I understand very well that discipline and why she did that. But it didn't change the fact that it was very problematic that the commission was allowing these things to be reviewed at that lower, prior to making having the hearings, making the list of designations for the year. But the relationship that we had to the Board of Estimate was simply, we were, because Mayor Koch was so pro-landmarks designation, he would basically just support our designations, and in the cases of the Broadway theaters, and I'm sure in other matters, they would fight for them. And it would be political horse trading that was going on. The other impact the mayor had, though, was that from time to time, there would be C of A matters that would come to the commission for review. Sometimes not C of A, sometimes reports to city agencies, where the office of the mayor would have, would be involved in the issue. One of the first ones that I encountered on the commission was South Street Seaport, which I was there when the Rouse Corporation first came in. And this is probably a very important moment in my period on the commission. It was announced that Rouse Corporation was going to collaborate with the South Street Seaport Historic Museum and restore a bunch of the buildings and bring in a bunch of shops and a food emporium and a marketplace and all the things they'd been doing in other cities in the United States. At that point, the two most prominent examples were in San Francisco and in Boston at Faneuil Hall. And several of the architect members of the commission had seen the restorations that had occurred in San Francisco and Boston and said they weren't great restorations in some cases. So I made a trip up to Boston to see Faneuil Hall, the Faneuil Hall Marketplace restoration. And the Faneuil Hall, it's comprised of probably four or five buildings and the public spaces around them. The Faneuil Hall building was beautifully restored. But the marketplace, the other buildings in the marketplace were just as valuable historically, perhaps not as beautiful, but just as valuable, had very problematic restorations. For instance, they took out the multi-pane windows and put single panes of glass in because the upstairs were going to be for offices. They eliminated the cobblestone streets and paved it with a solid mass of concrete. They eliminated curbs so that there wasn't a step down in height, and they made the pavement of the street, of the sidewalk, flush to the street, and then eliminated the demarcation of the sidewalk. So there was just a solid paving between buildings. You didn't see the old streetscape. One of the reasons they did that was that at various times of the year, they would allow sheds to be attached to the buildings. Mm-hmm. And when people were walking in the sheds, they didn't want to have a drop of a curb there in a cluttered shop front. The lampposts all looked like they came out of Better Homes and Gardens, as did the benches, all the furniture. And so it looked very suburbanized. It was, on the one hand, relative to what was happening in the United States, those projects were a revelation and a revolution, because they were bringing people downtown to have fun shopping in an urban setting after decades of everyone going out to the suburbs in their cars to go shop in shopping malls. So it was a reversal of that trend, right? And which, as we know, we look back now and we go, oh, that's the moment when it began, because now there is so much, in cities all across the United States, the urbanization is so strong, and people come to shop in the center of the city and enjoy the celebratory aspect of that. But the Rouse Corporation's work was one of the principal sources for the reversal of that trend. They understood that potential when other people didn't see it, and they could make it happen. So I went up to South Street Seaport and saw all of this and realized that it would be better not to have all that occur, particularly the loss of the street beds. Because the street bed pattern of Lower Manhattan along the shore is very, very important. One of the aspects that makes it so important is that there are streets there called like Beekman Slip, Lion Slip, and various slips, Peckman Slip. Mm-hmm. Well, those slips actually were notches in the shoreline. And those notches date back to a practice that came from our Dutch forebears, who were actually creating more than just slips. They were creating slips that went in far enough. They were almost canals. Mm-hmm. So although we didn't get a network of canals, our slips went in several blocks. And so it was the beginning of a network of canals, but never completed. So the city was, the plan was functioning influenced very much by Dutch cities. And those slips were the residual markers of that earlier urban topography. And one of the things that happened is the lines of the slips, unlike a street in which both curbs are parallel to one another, the lines of a slip were at such an angle that it was the opening was wider and at the water end and narrower at the inland side. So the slips were very important in terms of continuing our awareness of the relationship of the cityscape to its earliest, the topography, its earliest origins. And So to lose the markings of the curbs, the distinction between sidewalk, curb, and street lane, was very, very important in terms of the history of the place. Of course, everyone, I think, appreciates, I hope everyone appreciates, cobblestone street beds, but also understands that cobblestones often came from the weight that was put into ships when from ballast in order to balance ships out from when they were sailing. And so they would be in ships that were coming, the cobblestones themselves actually coming from European cities. And then they would get unloaded here and get put into the street. And because they would have some, the weight of the new shipment was different, and so they didn't need that same ballast. So a lot of our cobblestones, particularly down in the watery areas of Manhattan, have extraordinary origins, and it's important to keep them.
Yeah.
So that became a huge issue. And then when the first drawings came in for South Street Seaport, myself and the other architect commissioners along with Kent looked at them and saw they were going to eliminate this. They were going to do what they did in Boston, eliminate multi-pane windows, eliminate the street markings, have sheds that went all the way around buildings, and have all this terrible suburban-looking street hardware. So in the discussions we had, we were pretty clear we weren't in support of that, and that they could have as successful a development, that the success of their development wouldn't be compromised by having this proper street articulation of the history of the street, and by having lampposts that didn't look so suburban and whatever.
Right.
So we were determined to regulate. But then the night before our hearing, I happened to be home and I heard Mayor Koch on the news. And he was on the news and he was saying, you know, we have a new project coming in to New York. It's called the South Street Seaport Project. It's being done by the Rouse Corporation. And they are fantastic. They've revolutionized downtown development in Boston and San Francisco. Now they're coming into South Street Seaport. My administration has been working for 2 years, whatever it was, to make this happen, and it's beginning now. And I just want to send out a message to everyone in the bureaucracy of the city of New York. Don't make waves. Help this to happen. This is important to the future of the city. So something to that matter. I remember walking into the commission the next morning, and word, I don't know how many commissioners heard that, but enough did, and word was passed around. It was pretty clear what the mayor was saying,
yeah,
particularly to the Landmarks Commission. Don't slow this down. So I walked in and Kent was there. And he asked to meet with me independently. And the rest of the commissioners went into the hearing room. And he just said, are you willing to try to regulate this? And I said, yes. And he said, I want you to understand that we try to do this and you could lose your appointment. You would not be reappointed if you get the mayor mad enough. And I was young and I said, I'm only here to do what I think is best and not for whatever other reasons people can.
It seems a little prescient.
Yes. In any case, it was in my nature, obviously. So I said, yes. And he said, you should lead the debate on this. And I remember his reasoning was, you're less well known than the other commissioners, and so you're less likely to be quoted in the press, so you're less likely to be singled out. If Bill Conklin does this or Elliot does this, it's a different matter. And when I look at this in retrospect, I realize that what must have been happening is the other commissioners were sitting in the hearing room and must have realized, well, Kent and I were talking in private. And then when we got into the hearing room, and after the applicants had presented, it came time for the commissioners to start talking, they noticed that Kent was deferring to me. So I think they sort of figured out that we had a kind of game plan working here. But Kent never got their consent, never forewarned them. It just all was happening in the flow of the room. And so it was all kind of funny because I would say, well, I have a problem with the curbs. And then the other commissioners would go, you know, I really think this is a great development. It has to go forward for the future of the city. But I agree with Commissioner Tung. There's a problem with the curbs. And so it's kind of hilarious. One by one, they would kind of support my contentions, but they waited for me to make the contention. And then a curious thing began to happen. This whole process of the regulation of South Street Seaport and the museum took at least a year. And they came forward on multiple applications for the design of the market hall, the design of another building out on the pier, building, for the design of Skimmerhorn Row, for the design of individual buildings that were going to be restored as part of the museum, for buildings that were going to be restored as part of the commercial aspect. So this went on and on and on and on. And throughout all this, we pretty much observed the game roles we had established in the beginning. I led a lot of these discussions, and it appeared to someone from outside that I was of the primary force here, but that was an artificial perception.
Right.
And so we just kept that arrangement. A year later, I remember sitting in the room prior to that year later, that moment a year later, and there was an architect from Ben Thompson's office who was the guy who was the project architect for this, and I've forgotten his name. He was an Italian. He was a big, burly Italian guy, and he could draw beautifully. And every time I would review these things and say, this is, you know, the lamppost is terrible. You have to get a better lamppost. He would look so disappointed. And then he'd stand up and say something and fight for his lamppost or whatever it was. Loss of the curbs was a big, big deal. That was a lot of fights. And he would look so sad that he hadn't had his way. But then I began to notice something. He would come back with revised designs with extraordinary speed. I mean, he'd get a whole building designed, be back a month later, the whole building had been redesigned. I was curious about that. So on the day of the opening of South Street Seaport, there was a big open house, and the seaport closed off the whole zone. It had all been restored, all the shops were in, and everything that you could possibly want to eat was for free. And if you got a ticket to this, you just walked in, and there were, you know, 20 different groups of people making entertainment in the streets, and food, free food everywhere. It was this great celebration to which several thousand New Yorkers were invited. And the commissioners were. So I went down there, and I see this guy, and he has his tie loosened and his shirt off, his jacket off, and his sleeves rolled up, and he's been drinking a lot of beer. And he sees me on the other side of the crowd, and he comes rushing through the crowd, going, "Commissioner Tung, Commissioner Tung." I thought, oh boy, am I in for it now. And he comes up, and he grabs me, mm-hmm. and hugs me, and says, "Thank you so much." And he said, "Did you notice how quickly I had revised designs?" I said, "Yes, it was remarkable." He said, "Because those were the original designs. What you were asking for was what we wanted to do. Mm-hmm. But Rouse Corporation didn't want it. They had their people who were all thinking about marketing, whatever it was, and they didn't want that. So often the designs I was putting into you were the compromised designs that we had to work out for our clients. And you kept on asking for things that were more like what we really wanted to do. And so we ended up with more of the design that we wanted to build as a result of the commission's interaction." Of course, that was a great lesson for me, that could happen to architects, and that you wouldn't see it in public. They might not show it because their clients were there. That was a great lesson of Rouse Corporation. But it also was, in retrospect, a very important lesson about Kent and the relationship to the mayor's office. Because Kent was willing to allow that to happen. He was willing to allow that kind of confrontation to occur. And what then happened was, over the years I was a commissioner, there was a very sharp difference between the relationship of Kent's commission to the mayor's office on matters that were politicized and the mayor's office had interest in, and Gene's commission. And this gets to be a complex thing.
That was actually my next question for you.
Oh, about the difference between Kent and...
Because you had served under these two commissioners, I'm going to get a sense of their leadership styles and how you would contrast them and how those differences affected the commission's operations during their terms.
Okay, so we'll come back to this, and I'll begin by just saying this. I happen to be very lucky in serving under two really excellent chairs. Gene was excellent because he was what I would call an absolutely scrupulous professional. He was always, and he was so respectful of people coming in to testify and everyone in the public forum. And he was willing to hear everybody. He was willing to hear criticisms of himself. And he was just extremely thoughtful. So that was excellent. And in regard to design regulation, although he didn't agree initially with the more aggressive approach that Elliot and I were interested in, he gradually gave weight to it. So he allowed that to occur. Kent was a commissioner of an even higher level of excellence. To my mind, Kent marks the kind of excellence that you hope you get at the head of city agencies, but happens only once every two or three decades. It doesn't happen very, maybe even not that often. It seemed that every bit of Kent's energy was always directed towards making the best thing happen in whatever issue was on the table. So he was always looking for the most positive answer he could for the city. He was trying to do the maximum number of designations. He was trying to get the regulatory process to be more rigorous, get design review better. He was trying to get the idea of a computerized survey. He got the idea of creating a landmarks foundation. He just had constant number of new ideas, positive ventures that he would imagine, and he'd get them all activated. And he did it with a very limited number of staff. And I remember the staff would always seem so exhausted during the time when Kent was chair, because he had so much happening. But when you look at the productivity of the commission, it was extraordinary. All those new ventures were occurring, as well as setting records for the rate of designation and perfecting the regulatory process. Just because his positive vibes created a positive climate for everyone to work in, and it was very stimulating. And so he got a much higher level of productivity than Gene, which is not to say that Gene wasn't a very solid and substantial chair. I think he was. And there have been many times, I think, in the history of the Landmarks Commission now that we wish we could get Gene Norman back. But Kent is a different kind of standard. He's the standard of a kind of very rare excellence you can get in public life sometimes. So that's the fundamental difference. But it then would play out, there were more specific differences, and one of them was in designations, which we should talk about as a separate thing. Let's stay on regulation and the politicalization of the regulatory process. So Kent was more willing to take on City Hall in regard to various projects that came before the commission. And that meant also taking on other city agencies. And the most important, there were probably two really, really significant things. I'll tell the simple one first, and then the more complex one second. The first one that was really significant in terms of regulating other city agencies was Kent's idea to designate the tile work of the subway stations. For people who, or anyone who ever reads this tape, you can't imagine what it meant to designate those subway stations unless you understand how filthy they were. They were covered with grime. The city just wasn't washing them. And they couldn't be washed because there had been ad hoc conduit and signage applied all over the surfaces of the subway stations. That created all these nooks and crannies. You couldn't get them clean. So they were a mess, and the tile work was a mess. You could only see, there was probably at least 50% of the tile work was obscured by all the signage that was plastered in the stations, and all that signage was screwed into the ceramics. It was ruining tile work underneath it. And the conduit often had to run high, so it was going into the decorative band courses of the stations. The subway stations were so ugly and cacophonous. And if you were sensitive to design, you would stand on a subway station and eventually realize, you know, underneath all of that gunk and mess, there actually is something beautiful. But I think the number of people in the city who understood that there was something beautiful about the subway stations was a really small percentage of people. Okay. So this was an astounding kind of designation at the time, because on the surface, it all looked so ugly. And then Kent came forward with it, probably in the last year of his tenure. And he came forward with the idea to designate a select number of stations, obviously the very best ones. And it was, I think it was probably, you'd have to check, maybe 10 stations, something like that. And I remember when he brought it forward for discussion at the commission when we were calendaring. And he brought this forward, and he was very strongly in support of it, and so was Elliot. I had seen the beauty there, but I thought this was an extremely impractical thing. I thought, boy, this is never going to go through, because who can see the beauty there? I also knew, if you lived in New York at the time, you understood there was this ongoing effort by the MTA to try to find ways to restore the subway stations. And one of the things they were doing was they were putting up new tiles that were very thick and were acoustical, that were laid on top of the old tile work that theoretically reduced the sound in the station, the noise. The noise was terrible. The subway trains were also used, and we didn't know this, but this is one of these things that isn't well publicized. We didn't know that they were using asbestos brakes. Every time you were standing at a subway station, you would get this very distinctive smell of a burning. It was asbestos. Everyone was breathing asbestos in subway stations when the subway braked. So the whole brake system was unhealthy. It was also too noisy. Part of the answer to the noise was to make the tracks truer and to change the way that the wheels engaged with the tracks, and that greatly reduced noise. But the subway was such an awful environment on so many levels. And they were trying all of these ways of making the stations better and reducing the noise level. So it just seemed very unlikely that the city was going to suddenly turn around and go into this very delicate process of stripping away all this gunk and then replacing all the tiles and fixing it all up. It seemed so unlikely. So I am proud to say I was opposed to this at the executive session, because I remember my ignorance sometimes. And I remember Kent and Elliot just saying, "Tony, think about this for a second. This is really beautiful. Stop being stupid." And so we designated it. And I think several of the commissioners were probably questioning that. Then something remarkable happened. There must have been an application for, it probably was the first station that they were going to do. And so the MTA sent a designer over to work with someone at the Landmark staff. And the big issue was, if you could find a replacement tile for the white glazed tiles that form the mass of the station wall. And that white glazed tile was a magical tile. It was not a pure white. It was a kind of ivory white that was creamy, that had a luster that wasn't too bright, but was lustrous enough that it had a sheen. There was some kind of perfect balance about this. And they started coming forward at C of A, at our C of A sessions, but it was for a report, because it's a report to another city agency. And they brought the tile samples forward. And we kept on saying no, it just wasn't working. All the rest of it was fine. They were going to restore all the detailing, but that tile stuff was awful. Then finally, after this must have been going on for several sessions, finally our staff person found a substitute replacement tile from Great Britain. They found a tile manufacturer in Great Britain who was willing to manufacture these tiles at such a cost that they were ridiculously cheap compared to the tiles we were looking at in the United States, and they had the right luster and they were hard enough and whatever other attributes you had to have. So they restored that first bunch of stations, and they came in with such great numbers. And then at somewhere in the process, they came back and said to us, either in public or in private, will you designate more stations? Wow. Okay. And what we now know, in fact, happened was this was such an economic solution that they adopted it for almost all of the subway stations. So almost all of the subway stations in New York are brought back, were brought back as historic subway stations. That, you have to chalk that up to Kent Barwick. I mean, I don't think a lot of people in New York understand how this occurred. And I've never seen Kent celebrated for this. But he was the one that had this idea to do this, what seemed an incredibly unlikely thing. And it ended up, because our staff was so good, it ended up being the most economic solution and adopted for the whole city. If you ask a visitor to the city these days about what are the significant attributes of New York that make it distinctive, as with other places, they'll say, well, the mass transit system, the subway stations. You go to London, you go to the subway stations there, and they have a particular arc to the ceiling, all kinds of attributes, and in Paris also. In New York, too, our tile subway stations are very distinctive. And that was Kent. In that situation, there wasn't an adversarial condition with the other city agency. But the other thing he did that was so brilliant at the time, which did involve a semi-adversarial or potentially semi-adversarial relationship, was the regulation of city parks. Because during the time I was on the commission, it was early in the process of trying to bring back Central Park. And the way it was brought back initially was one little project at a time. And the city had come out of a period of economic hardship for several mayoralties up until the time of Ed Koch. And once Mayor Koch became mayor, he performed this extraordinary feat of bringing the city's economic house in order, and something nobody thought was possible. And he did it from inside the city, and there was an oversight board that was established for the city's economy during that time, so the mayors didn't have control of their own budgets, and within, I think, 2 years, and certainly by the end of his first term, that was gone, because Ed Koch had brought the city back into solvency, and so the city was running its own budget.